If you and I were living in 18th century London, there was a liquid that we could drink that cured gout, it prevented indigestion, and it was so cheap we could quaff it until we lost the ability to swallow. Workers got paid with it, children and houses were sold for it, and it was drunk with such abandon it made men impotent and women sterile. It was one of the reasons why the population plummeted in the English capital for a while.
Gin was the crack cocaine of the 1800s. I mean, it just about destroyed a nation, strangely enough. It's got this very strange rollercoaster history.
Gin, the opium of the people. Londoners drank 10 million gallons of it a year because the government hardly taxed it. No wonder some of the names it went by were Cuckold's Comfort, Lady's Delight and Knock Me Down. 2 centuries on and a hemisphere away, I'm visiting a distillery on the outskirts of Melbourne. It's one of the few in Australia dedicated to making craft gin, but government excise still plays a role.
We have to have a sort of caged Hannibal Lecter-style area. So as soon as it leaves this area, I pay the tax within a week.
Actually. Every week?
Every Monday.
So if we stay in this area and drink in this area, we're not going to be taxed on the gin we drink.
Actually, I hadn't even thought about it like that. They might weigh you on the way out the door. Do it on consumption.
Bring it on.
It's cleaner than water. It's cheaper than porter. It's gin. It helps you get through all that life throws at you. Gin.
We're not related, are we?
No, I don't think so. Well, I mean, we own most of the Highlands.
That's exactly right. We'll get rid of those McDonald's one day.
Yeah.
Cameron McKenzie's my name, and I'm the distiller and one of the directors for Four Pillars Gin. We're based out here in Warrandyte, right on the Melbourne edge of the Yarra Valley.
What distinguishes the craft gin you produce and what I can buy at any liquor store down the street?
Yeah, look, I guess it's not dissimilar to beer and wine in many respects, and craft spirits is just starting to happen in Australia. It's already gone crazy in the UK and the US. What we're talking about here is we don't have a continuous still. That style is kind of sausage factory spirits production. What we wanted to do was do small batch handcrafted spirits that we don't mind if the batches have some really subtle differences all the way through. Botanicals will change throughout the year.
Explain what botanicals are.
Well, the botanicals are the flavourings in our product. And gin, the main rule for gin is you have to have juniper berries.
Why?
Well, that was the basic flavouring going right back to when the Dutch made Geneva or Geneva.
Which is where gin gets its name from.
Exactly right, yes.
There's London gin, slow gin, there's distilled gin, then there's just gin. So what characterises all these different names for gin?
Yeah, London Dry is probably the most widely distributed gin and probably the most well-known gin going around. And that's a really juniper-dominant style of gin, really aromatic, but highly sort of pine needles and citrus, if you like.
Why London? Is that where it originated from?
Well, it started obviously with the Dutch and then quickly moved over to the UK, and the UK, I guess, kind of hijacked something that was made originally by the Dutch. And, you know, slow gin is a gin that is then steeped in slow berries, which is like a small plum. Old Tom gin is one that we're working on here as well, which is a barrel-aged gin.
And Old then Tom? Where?
Tom was basically a picture of a black cat on a building that was selling bootleg gin, and this originated in the UK as well. Old Tom's then almost got hijacked by the Americans pre-Prohibition and became a much more handcrafted product and a much more refined product, and we're a classic cocktail ingredient. We saw some last year in the US that were extraordinary, and we thought, no, we really, really want to make one of those.
I'll fight the Army Navy, yes, me and my gin.
Recorded in 1928, in the midst of American Prohibition, renowned blues singer Bessie Smith with Me and My Gin. And the spirit she was coveting would have been distilled using the same techniques employed by Cameron McKenzie in 21st century Australia. Perhaps Bessie even drank gin from the same brand of still.
All the good old bottle of gin, we'll get it all the time.
This incredible stainless steel and copper apparatus that stretches up to the ceiling and looks like it's from about 1865. Tell us the story behind this, because I think Carl, the manufacturer, have a very long and reputable history.
All the guys I really liked in the US were using a Carl still. Was certainly the most expensive of all the stills. This is the reason I'll homeschool my kids, I suspect. It's a really beautiful still, and all the gins I liked in the US were out of Carl stills. So,
what makes it so special?
It's beautifully engineered. The Germans know what they're doing. Carl have been making stills for over 100 years. They only make maybe 25 to 30 of these a year. They hand make everything, and it's a really beautiful still. Her name is Wilma. She's named after my late mother, who was quite beautiful, I might say. But my mum, I'm the youngest of five boys, so it's fair to say she could get pretty hot under the collar as well. So we felt it was a really appropriate tribute to her. So Wilma sits here in Warrandyte. She's a 450-litre copper pot still with a swan's neck that extends out the top here.
It looks like an old gramophone trumpet turned upside down, actually.
This copper, the use of copper, is just makes these such a work of art.
Does the copper actually add to the flavour of the gin?
Copper reacts with spirit and removes sulfides. It's obviously very good to hold heat, and we need to hold heat through this process, and it also helps clean the botanicals on the way through. But it definitely does react with spirit. It softens the spirit and makes the spirit much, much cleaner all the way through.
The spirit Cameron McKenzie is talking about is the 450 litres of neutral grain spirit that goes into every batch of gin that Wilma makes.
So the first vapours to come off, or spirits as they used to be called, will be a much higher concentration of alcohol. And that's all vodka is. Vodka is just unfinished gin in my eyes.
450 litres goes in, about 130 litres comes out, having gone through heating and condensing across plates and through pipes. But it's not as simple as that. It took Cameron 18 months of testing, tasting and smelling flavours before he and his team had a combination of botanicals they were really happy with.
We wrote down modern Australia, what is modern Australia, and we didn't want kangaroos and wombats. We looked at a lot of menus, we spoke to a few chefs, so we narrowed down our botanicals to basically include the spices of Southeast Asia right through to the Middle East, but start with juniper. Juniper's very, really fresh pine needles. You know,
Reminds me of oil paint.
I
can smell it.
Absolutely. And on its own, you know, it needs flavourings with it.
So they're from Macedonia, are they? And Greece?
They're Macedonia and Italy.
Italy.
This is coriander, and this is from India. Now, this is Tasmanian pepperberry leaf, lemon myrtle. Cardamom, that's from Guatemala, and angelica root is quite an earthy, bitter substance. It's related to dill and parsley.
So this is the fixative. This is the one that keeps the botanicals within the flavour molecules of the spirit.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol's a fixative too, but this does exactly that. But it's also a bittering agent.
Yes.
The second last one is lavender. So if anyone's a lavender grower, give me a call. Our final one that was sort of, I guess, the icing on the cake for us was the use of fresh oranges in our botanical basket.
And not just orange peel, which is often used as a botanical flavouring, but whole oranges, so the inside as well.
We use biodynamic oranges. We don't want any wax on the orange. And we use the whole orange. We just cut it in half and we sort of sit them gently into the botanical basket. So they're like little cups, if you like. And you haven't lived until you've eaten an orange that's been steamed in gin for 6 hours.
Does it blow your head off?
Well, there's no alcohol left, but at the end of the distillation, they retain all their sugar and their acids. So they're actually, you're like eating a really warm, beautiful cooked orange, but it's picked up all of these botanical flavours. We've made some marmalade with them. You know, I'm making some orange bitters with them, and they're just extraordinary. So you better taste some gin.
All right. Okay, then. Sure. But I wanted to do this properly, so I left Cameron behind at the distillery and travelled into the centre of Melbourne, where I entered the Gin Palace. And I met a bartender and gin specialist, Trish Brew. Yes, that really is her last name.
Consumers more than ever are starting to realise that there are really good quality products out there. And it's not a matter of having the cheapest, you know, gin on the market anymore. People are really, really caring about what they're putting into their mouths, which is great.
Can we try a little something here? Can you make something happen in that glass and show me your techniques at work?
We're going to use some salted kumquats that my boss Vernon has picked from his trees in the Yarra Valley, actually, which is where Four Pillars is currently being made. So fancy that.
Salted kumquats.
It tastes like marmalade. It's absolutely gorgeous. Rattling around here.
So Trish has got a beautiful long-handled silver spoon to ladle the salted kumquats from the rather fetching plastic tray into the, into the burgundy glass. Now,
absolutely.
Here comes the gin.
We're going 50 mils of that.
And how much salted kumquats in that glass?
Oh, I would say about 6 or 7 would be nice. We're going to pop some ice in there.
Now, if my boss doesn't happen to have a kumquat tree in his backyard, where can you source salted kumquats?
Firstly, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's fruit stores at the moment that would be selling them, specialty fruit stores.
It's in season, that's right, yeah.
I'm going to use that beautiful Fever Tree Mediterranean tonic we just talked about. It's less bitter, it's nice and light. You'll definitely be able to taste the gin. Quite a good splash of that, but not too much because you still want to taste that beautiful gin.
Trish is delving into various cold boxes to look for the right thing.
Well, here's one I prepared earlier.
Here's one. Oh, yeah.
Nice big piece of red grapefruit and some star anise.
Ah, well, because I've talked to Cameron about this.
Yes, very aromatic. They use star anise. And grapefruit goes perfectly with their gin. And voila, there we go. Just pop that on top for an aromatic effect.
How many times a week are you making that kind of drink for customers over the bar here?
We're making them daily, quite a lot, quite a lot of them. Now for the taste test, Michael, why don't you have a taste and see what you think?
Oh, look, if you insist. Thank you. It's enormous. I can feel my bicep bulging just to bring the glass up to me. That is really quite lovely, isn't it?
Excellent. You know, gin and tonic is a drink that stood the test of time. You know, first it was there for medicinal purposes. Now it's just quite a nice sipper. And, I mean, why stick to your standard? Make it fancy. You're a gin palace. You can have a gin anywhere in the world.
Gin is the tonic to cure all your woes. Gin is the tonic to cure all your woes.
Bartender and gin specialist Trish Brew. And before her, boutique gin producer Cameron McKenzie.